That case, therefore, the government will go first. Counsel for the government. We'll call the case, U.S. v. Katso. Now, counsel for the government, would you like to proceed?
Thank you, Chief Judge Baker, and may it please the court. I'm Captain Thomas Alford, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Catherine Oler, represent the United States in this case. And if I may, Chief Judge Baker, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
So granted.
The government's DNA expert in this case, Mr. David Davenport, in accordance with both the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment and Military Rule of Evidence 703, properly conducted his own expert analysis of the DNA profiles in this case, in addition to properly relying on the initial DNA examiner's findings in reaching his own independent expert opinion as a technical reviewer. The CCA thus erred and should be reversed.
Counsel, where in the documents, and I couldn't tell by looking at the record, where did Fisher initially identify Katso as the contributor of this specimen? Was that from the chain of custody documents? Was it from another document? Where does that come from, which is reflected in his report?
Your Honor, if you actually look at the report, which was attached to both the government's motion and to the defense's motion, as well as, I believe, Mr. Davenport testified about it in the joint appendix from pages 35 to 65, that's where the link comes from and where Mr. Davenport actually talks about Mr. Fisher making that initial link.
So Mr. Davenport got that information from Mr. Fisher's report?
There's two things.
The identity information.
There's two things that going on, Your Honor, if I could answer your question in two parts. The first part was that Mr. Davenport reviewed not just the report itself, not that final three-page document. He reviewed the entire case file. So based on those internal documents, based on the chain of custody within that case file, et cetera, which according to, if you look at Justice Thomas's concurrences in all of these Supreme Court cases, doesn't have any indicia of solemnity or anything like that. All of those documents are what he relied on, and of course, Mr. Davenport came in before the report was even published.
Okay, but what I'm trying to figure out is where exactly did Fisher get that information, and then can we determine whether or not Davenport took the information from Fisher's report or whether he went back and redid those steps? And where does the record reflect that?
Your Honor, if you look at the joint appendix on page, I believe, 35 and 36, if this is what you're getting at as far as the chain of custody, the actual samples come in from the same nurse. They're mailed from law enforcement, same nurse to law enforcement, then mailed to the lab. It comes in. He discusses how that process goes and how all those chain of custody documents are then uploaded into the system.
But the chain of custody normally doesn't identify the accused. That name isn't on the chain of custody. It just says, this specimen number came here, went there, this person looked at it, boom, boom, boom. So I'm trying to find out where the identification of Katso came. I mean, it's in the report, so we know that Fisher obtained it somewhere. And I'm trying to figure out where he obtained it and whether or not Davenport looked at that source or Davenport just looked at this. That's my question.
Can I ask the question?
Yeah.
Pile on here. Davenport testifies that the swab that was taken by the same nurses was Katso's.
Yes, sir.
Where does that knowledge come from? Does that come, well, there's the question. And then I can do multiple choice, or you can answer the question, but then
yes,
we'll move
yes,
to multiple
Your Honor,
choice.
It comes from, not, and I, perhaps I didn't clarify, the batch numbers are located on the chain of custody documents. So the batch numbers are where the link comes from. This is kind of what AFCA's sticking point was. Well, how do you know? Well, this is just like a urinalysis case. A surrogate expert in a urinalysis case has no more knowledge about a batch number that lines up to an accused than this expert, who actually is better than the surrogate expert. In fact, this expert is essentially a second expert because he conducted his own analysis, granted his own analysis of the last few steps, but he was also the technical reviewer who looked at the entire case file, not just the report, the case file, and that's what also separates this from all the Supreme Court cases where they talk about and have concerns about these certified reports being put in by the prosecution. That was not done here.
Where is the batch number equated to Katzel? Where in the record, and who found that?
Your Honor, if I could just read a few points.
Well, I understand all your arguments, and they're fine. I'm just asking this specific question, and maybe you don't know. I mean, and that's fine, too.
The actual batch number, the number itself is not listed in the record from the testimony. It's attached to appellate exhibits in the report, basically, is where the end conclusion comes from. But I think that if there's circumstantial evidence and there's certainly inferences that can be drawn, that the expert linked those two things together. So the expert can look at all of these things and say, at the end of the day, I saw that this came in, it was scanned, the documents were properly scanned, everything was done properly, everything, all the protocols were followed. I see that it went through every step of the process. And then just to make sure, at the end, I'm going to confirm and I'm going to run both run the allele charts, compare them at the end. So that's how it was done. And I think you can draw an inference, the circumstantial evidence, that this came in. The same nurses did testify that they had collected it and sent it to the lab. So it is circumstantial evidence.
When the same nurses send it in, do they write on the package CATSO, or do they write on the package batch number 9, or do they write in the package some other thing?
Their testimony is not in the joint appendix, so I can't point you to the joint appendix number, but they did testify as to that it was the batch number lined up to CATSO.
The same nurses testified to that?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And that's in the record of trial, if not the joint appendix?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is it that the stuff's not testimonial, or it's not proffered with for the truth of the matter, or is it that Davenport did enough on his own to render him other than a conduit, or is it both?
I think it's all three, Your Honor. He did all of his own analysis, and consistent with this court's opinion in United States versus Blazer, you listed two different things that an expert can do. Obviously, an expert can review machine-generated data, but in addition to that, an expert can rely on but not repeat testimonial hearsay that is otherwise an appropriate basis for an expert opinion, so long as the expert opinion arrived at is the expert's own. That's what was done in this case. And different from all of those Supreme Court cases is he was actually an expert who was present at the lab, who knew the procedures and who reviewed it. But as far as hearsay goes, certain portions of his testimony was not offered for the truth of the matter asserted because he was merely articulating, for example, the semen. He was articulating where the DNA actually came from and was explaining how he reached that final conclusion that the DNA profiles matched up at the end. It's also not testimonial, arguably, because, again, as I said, the case file itself, not necessarily the report, which more than likely, according to this court's jurisprudence as well as the Supreme Court's, would be testimonial, but the case file itself did not bear any indicia of solemnity.
Counsel, that's not the test, except for Justice Thomas. I mean, that's his test. That's the end of the test for him, right? But he doesn't have even one other justice that agrees that that's the only test. So please don't argue to this court that that's the law now.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess what I'm arguing is that I'm distinguishing the Supreme Court cases because all of the Supreme Court cases that deal with these types of issues deal with certified documents being put into evidence. Bullcoming, Melendez, Diaz, that was usually the deciding factor, and he is the fifth vote. So his view on it, well, not just positive, certainly important. I'd also like to point out Justice Sotomayor's concurrence in Bullcoming against New Mexico. She was also the deciding vote in a 5-4 opinion. She said, and I quote, "This case is not a case in which the person testifying is a supervisor, reviewer, or someone else with a personal, albeit limited, connection to the scientific test at issue. It would be a different case if, for example, a supervisor who observed an analyst conducting a test testified about the results or a report about such results." Then she goes on to say, "This is not a case in which an expert witness was asked for his independent opinion about underlying testimonial reports that were not themselves admitted into evidence." And she went ahead and she cited Federal Rule 703, which is the analog to, Military Rule of Evidence 703 is the analog, military analog to that. She was distinguishing that particular case, saying that that case wasn't a case like we have here. This is exactly the situation where we have an expert who is qualified, who was not opposed, his expert qualifications were not objected to by the counsel, who testified about the entire process.
This may be a bit repetitive, because you'll circle back to what you've just said, but I have a list of what I believe are appellee's primary testimonial objections, and giving the appellee the opportunity to correct my characterization of these, can I go through each and you quickly tell us why each is or is not testimonial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Fair enough. All the evidence was received properly. So this is Davenport in some manner conveying this information. All the evidence was received properly and in its properly sealed condition.
As we highlighted in our brief, Your Honor, that is one point that could be considered testimonial. If he's not just merely talking about that the protocols were followed, but if he was talking about that he himself was certifying that, that would be a problematic statement, Your Honor. And as we argued, we believe that's the only one.
So then you would argue prejudice on that one?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay.
CA, who's the victim here, CA's and appellee's kits were tested properly according to the procedure at USCIL.
And that would be him as a technical reviewer knowing the process. And he actually said the protocols, he knew what the protocols were, and he's testifying that the protocols were actually followed, Your Honor.
Semen was identified on CA's various swabs.
In his testimony, he initially couches that as my opinion, is that semen was identified. As I argued before, that he's merely offering to show where the actual DNA came from that resulted in the profile that he was able to then match up with the known sample from Apelli.
Is this a fun game? Next, two more. The samples taken from appellant contained a mixture of CA's and Apelli's DNA.
That he can testify to because he was involved at the end result where he actually had the profile, so he could say that there were two different, if he was able to follow those batch numbers and corresponding back to the swabs and to the known samples, he himself had personal knowledge about that in addition to the fact that he reviewed the entire case file himself from beginning to end, soup to nuts.
And then finally, Apelli's DNA profile matched the DNA taken from CA's swabs.
Again, Your Honor, that is something that is a test that he himself conducted. He ran those computer tests, and I just want to make a point of clarification that the statistical analysis that he did was the very last step. The step he did before that, he actually did conduct himself the interpretation, which is the comparing of the known samples with the computer allele charts with the question samples.
I also, counsel, this morning you're talking about using the phrases that he reviewed the entire case file, and he redid the last few steps. I'd like to turn your attention, though, to footnote 6 in the CCA opinion, where the court stated, it is not inconceivable that the appellant could argue that sample contamination, sample switching, mislabeling could have produced test results matching the appellant's DNA profile to that found in the victim's sample. Now, Davenport wasn't there, and he was not the person who took the DNA from the evidence. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when it comes down to a confrontation clause issue, doesn't that provide fertile ground for the defense counsel to attack how this was done?
Your Honor, I would draw a comparison to the urinalysis cases that this court has dealt with. Even though in those cases there's certainly a lot more machine-generated data, there's always going to be human factors involved in forensic testing. Now the question is, do you have to, and every person that's there can have some amount of error, inject some error into the process. So that alone is not enough to say that you need to call every single individual or that you need to call every single person in the chain of custody. If you do want to call somebody, though, they have to have sufficient knowledge. And as this court said in Blazer, that quote, that an expert did not personally perform the tests upon which his opinion is based is explorable upon cross-examination, but that goes to weight rather than to the admissibility of that expert's opinion. And that's actually what the defense counsel did in this case. They questioned Mr. Davenport, and they said, you actually didn't induct X, Y, and Z. And that's what you expect a defense counsel to do, and that's how they attack that. They also...
So then are you saying that the government has the ability to decide the viability of the questioning of the witness that the government has said, this is who we're going to bring in for our witness at that point? We're going to bring down this shade so that you can't see beyond that by bringing forward the person who actually conducted the test.
The government does that at their own peril. And I don't think the Confrontation Clause requires that the government put on, I don't want to say this was a weak case, it was a relatively weaker case than had they actually called the expert. But it does not make that the government put on actually that individual. But again, the government does that at their own peril.
Okay, so if the government does this at its own peril, what would you have this court say in its opinion that would spell out to the military judge and the government what exactly our standards would be so that they can determine what the peril is?
Your Honor, I would ask that this court rule consistent with Blazier 2, which says that, which reaffirms the principle that an expert can review even testimonial hearsay and reach his or her own conclusions, as long as you're not smuggling in backdoor testimonial hearsay through that testimony. Now, I want to distinguish this, too, from those Supreme Court cases, because this is where all these principles derive from. And I think Williams against Illinois was the high watermark for the Supreme Court as far as how far they're willing to go in the field of forensics. Now, in that particular case, even, the Supreme Court found as a very minimum, and they didn't reach a certain rationale, but the minimum that they agreed on was that the testimony was permissible. That case was far worse than this case because the expert in that case was not a technical reviewer. The expert in that case reviewed a certified document. Well, Justice Thomas didn't find it was certified, but they reviewed the report. Whereas in this case, the technical reviewer, and I can't stress this enough, went through and looked at all the raw data, looked at everything in the case file that had been scanned in, starting from when those samples showed up to the lab. And if this court were to say that that can't happen and that the only circumstance is where the actual person who did the test has to come testify, it would essentially render a military rule of evidence 703 a hollow rule.
But there was no majority for that rule that you have just stated that the Supreme Court adopted. They didn't adopt it. They had four that said it wasn't presented for the truth of the matter asserted. Justice Thomas specifically rejected that and said that it wasn't formal enough. And the other four said that it was submitted for the truth of the matter asserted. So we don't have a majority anywhere, and I don't see where we can get any real guidance out of that as far as precedential value is concerned.
I think it shows the extent of Justice Thomas's influence, and when you then fall back on Bullcoming against New Mexico, that particular case held that the report in that case was actually certified and submitted. That was the bridge too far for the Supreme Court. Where an expert's actually involved in the lab, reviewed it himself, and then testifies, that is completely permissible. And if with this court's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of
that. Well, I have one question.
I have a question to ask you, man. I don't disagree. I don't even know that you need to have someone that did all the testing in the lab, though you're stressing that. But you're not suggesting that the mere fact that this individual reviewed stuff then allows him to repeat testimonial hearsay, if in fact that's what he did.
No, Your Honor, no, absolutely no.
So if we find that there were statements that he gave, right, that were not based on his own personal knowledge, meaning that it's not his own independent opinion, but he's merely saying what someone else already said, that the fact that he did a bunch of tests himself doesn't help you, does it?
It doesn't, Your Honor, but again, that goes to exactly what he said. With regard to the seal, that the evidence came sealed, that's likely problematic and the government would argue harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But the other things, that everything else he testified to, he had personal knowledge of because he had...
And the record reflects that he has personal knowledge of all those things.
Yes, Your Honor.
Every single one of them.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does your brief identify where that personal knowledge is obtained from the joint appendix or the record?
I believe it does, Your Honor, and I think that if you look at the joint appendix, as I said, that As long as he is testifying about things that the case file and the data that he himself reviewed, then he is allowed to do that, as long as he's not parroting back hearsay. The other exception may be the semen testimony, but that testimony, again, is just him testifying about where the DNA actually came from.
But isn't that critical to the case?
What's critical to the case, Your Honor, is the ultimate DNA testing that links the fact that the two of them had sex. That's what is important. The semen is arguably superfluous because the DNA is what linked the two. And even defense counsel didn't contest the fact that the two had sex.
But the DNA came from the semen.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that is critical, right?
Well,
I mean, the fact that the DNA came from the semen and that the semen is his semen.
It's certainly a factor, Your Honor, but the ultimate conclusion is that the DNA was found on the victim. That's what really, and I would say that it's a factor because even the trial counsel didn't argue in closing argument about the semen, Your Honor, and that's reflected in the joint appendix as well.
Judge Stuckey, there is a caveat in the plurality in Williams, and that is this is a bench trial. This isn't a bench trial. This is a members' trial. How does that cut?
Your Honor, I think the fact finder ought not matter. The thing that mattered...
Well, I think Justice Alito had some concerns over, what can go in front of a judge and what can go in front of members.
The judge was better suited, Justice Alito found, in that particular case. He could discern what was offered for the truth of the matter and what was not offered for the truth of the matter. In that particular case. So as far as that goes, but the government would argue that that's not a dispositive factor in the analysis because ultimately the members are going to be instructed and they're presumed to follow the law just as the military judge is.
Thank you, counsel. We'll have some time on rebuttal as well. Counsel for the appellee, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of this honorable court, may it please the court. My name is Major Nicholas Carter, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Joy Primoli, represent the appellee, Airman Joshua Katso, in this matter. The Air Force Court did not hear when they applied this court's precedent in precedent to the United Supreme Court and decided that the following statements, that all testing was done according to the proper procedure and protocols, that's on JA 293-95, that the appellee's DNA was on the complaining witness, and the complaining witness DNA was on the appellee, that's a JA 295. The evidence was received properly, and that was on JA 293, and its serology was done correctly and showed presence of semen, and that's on JA 294. This evidence was all testimonial hearsay that was repeated by the expert. First and first, Your Honor, the government stated that he had personal knowledge. There's nothing in the record to show he had personal knowledge.
That was my question, which is all of the things that the government just testified he had done and had personal knowledge about. Where is that?
There's no necessarily evidence as to where that comes from.
It's in the amicus brief, correct?
There's some in the amicus brief, but it doesn't even get into that. The amicus brief cites the 294 in the joint appendix, which does not state what they cite for it. What is clear is that on page 49 of the joint appendix, the expert...
Wait, what's clear is what?
On page 49 of the joint appendix, the government's Mr. Davenport says this was the only report that was compiled, was this report that he looked at. So he looked at this only report, and then he repeated what he found from this report, and if there's other checklists included in the file or something like that, none of that's particularly in the record. Let alone when you look at that also in the Air Force Court's opinion, where they found that there was definitely no evidence of that kind of thing within the record. And they don't just have the joint appendix. They have the entire record.
And so the government could be speaking correctly based on their own personal knowledge as to what Mr. Davenport did, but it's not in the record. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not in the record.
So for our purposes, did it happen?
I believe for your purposes, it doesn't happen, Your Honor. It didn't happen, Your Honor. So this was testimony, and
I guess let me ask you another related question to that. You don't disagree, for example, or maybe you do disagree. So let me ask a more neutral question. Do you agree or disagree that it would be possible for Mr. Davenport to give the exact testimony that he gave so long as he established his personal knowledge?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. If he was there,
So this isn't a matter of the actual initial expert is the person that always has to come and testify. It's a matter of how the information was presented.
Yes, Your Honor. And if you look at, I think it's from Joint Appendix 79 to about 81, where the defense counsel is cross-examining during the 39 session of Mr. Davenport, he's going through all the things that he did do, things he did not do, and things that he did not know. Well, if Mr. Davenport had redone all of those tests, he could definitely test that. This isn't a situation where you have an accident reconstruction expert who's taking another look at all of the evidence and coming to his own independent opinion. In this case, what he did is he took all these things that somebody else did, a coworker who was hired the same day who trusted, and said what he said was okay. And that resulted in the identification. This is more than just a chain of custody. An identification of an accused given by an expert who did not do the test and did not know if that test could have been contaminated, did not know if that test had been switched, or any of those kinds of things.
Wait a minute. What you're suggesting now is that in order for someone to testify, they have to go and redo all the tests themselves.
They have to have personal knowledge of it. So if they had witnessed, if Mr. Davenport had witnessed Mr. Fisher of it, that would be personal knowledge of it. But if he doesn't have any personal knowledge of the tests, he's not going to be able to do it, or he looks at it. I mean, Mr. Davenport could have testified that the numbers that came from the machine did generate it matched to these numbers. But what he couldn't do was say that it was the appellee's DNA that was on the complaining witness's DNA. That is the pivot point that changed this from an expert testimony to repeating hearsay.
So in your view, he has to redo those actual tests, the DNA tests?
If he wanted to testify, or the government could have done what they should have done and waited the 2 days or the 3 days until Mr. Fisher was done with his temporary absence.
So you disagree with Justice Sotomayor's concurrence in Bullcoming, where she says this is not a case in which the person testifying is a supervisor or viewer or someone else with a personal, albeit limited, connection to the scientific tested issue?
Well,
you're saying what she really means to say there is that the person has to be directly involved in all the tests if they're going to draw a conclusion from it?
Well, Justice Sotomayor says that. She says a supervisor who observed an analyst conducting. Okay, again, and that would come from personal knowledge. This came from the oral argument in that case where a hypothetical is two people doing something together, could they testify to
it? What about a reviewer? She uses the language reviewer.
Well, if the reviewer observed him doing that, that's one thing. And if not, it would be what he reviewed, he could testify of his personal knowledge of. But he can't testify what a different analyst did, and he can't...
So in your theory, that would seem to imply that Fisher could not have testified except with respect to all the things he personally did.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or observed, so he couldn't say it arrived in the mailroom because he wasn't there in the mailroom watching it arrive in the mailroom.
No, Your Honor, but what he could say is that I got it, and then they could say, well, how did you get it? Well, typically what happens is it arrives in the mailroom. I'm assuming it arrived in the mailroom because I ended up, you know, being assigned to it, and then I grabbed it, and then I opened it, and the package hadn't been affected.
What quantum of personal involvement is necessary for somebody like Davenport to testify? You seem to be saying that it's a very great quantum, and that if he didn't have hands-on involvement in all this stuff personally, he can't testify.
I think it depends on what.
And I don't think that's what the Supreme Court has said. I don't think it's what this court said.
I mean, that's kind of the problem, counsel. It's like the government wants us to rely on things that aren't apparently in the record, and you want us to basically undo all the case law that we've had, right? Because we've never said, and the Supreme Court has never said, that the expert has to redo all the tests that they've said, that the other person did. What we've said is that they can form an independent, they have to form an independent expert opinion, and they can do it based on work that has been done by other people. What they cannot do is come in and make ultimate conclusions or statements that they don't have any basis for, right, other than repeating the testimony of somebody else, okay? So, for example, there's probably no reason that Mr. Davenport couldn't have come in and testified. In my expert opinion, based on my review of all this stuff, this sample matches this sample, right?
He could do that, right?
So what are the things that he went beyond that sort of testimony in doing?
Well, what he did is he didn't just say.
Do you understand what I'm saying? Because you apparently want us to go way far over here. The government wants us to do something different based on information you're saying isn't in the record. So I'm saying, based on the law that we've established and what we've said an expert may do, how did he go beyond that?
And I apologize if I came across trying to expand the law. I think if we apply Sweeney and we apply the cases that this court has handed down, I think we come to the correct conclusion, which is what the Air Force Court. But what happened in this case is that he didn't just say these two samples match, he identified it specifically as to CATSA. And there's nothing in the record to show that he came to an independent expert opinion except for his talismanic statement.
Isn't that a distinction without a difference? If 246810 is CATSO, he can say it's 246810, but he can't say it's CATSO.
I mean, to a point, Your Honor, yes. I mean, he can't identify. There's nothing that he'd gotten from his own personal knowledge to say that this is from CATSO. His own personal knowledge was this is a machine data spit out, and this matches this sample.
He can't look at the number and somewhere it says 246810 equals CATSO. Somewhere in this records or this file or somewhere in the bowels of the government, you've got that equation. And he can't say that?
Well, there are certain things that experts can testify to, and Blazer makes that clear.
I don't think he's even testifying as an expert here. He's saying these numbers match.
And again, saying that numbers match does not violate the Confrontation Clause.
Mm-hmm.
But in all the statements that Mr. Davenport stated that, and just the numbers match in and of themselves, is not necessarily even relevant to what this is. I mean, they could put on evidence that these numbers match. Well, it doesn't really matter unless we know
the... Well, the defense could always put in evidence as to contamination or sloppy practice or anything like that.
But absent that,
where are we?
Going to Judge Stuckey's question, can the expert not look at the report and say number 12345 is the number assigned to CATSO?
That would be repeating hearsay. If he looks at a report that somebody else has written with the eye towards trial, he would be repeating hearsay.
How does he then testify to that, if ever?
Well, he may not have to. They may have to put on other evidence to do that, or they may have to...
He has to be the person who personally assigned the number to CATSO, in your view.
Yeah, I apologize, Your Honor. I may have gotten twisted around in that question.
Well, you said that it's testimonial if he says, I've looked at the report based on my own independent capacity to read reports and understand what they say. The following numbers have been assigned to the following name. He's not allowed to say that.
Well, he says it could be assigned, but he kind of goes beyond that in this case. And what he says is that this DNA is his and this DNA is hers, and they've matched upon each other. What he can't do is repeat the testimonial hearsay that's included within the report.
Where in this record is that document that equates CATSO to the batch numbers at issue?
Your Honor, the only thing that equates those batch numbers to this is the report that's in the appellee exhibits, on the joint appendix, and it's in the 204.
Fisher's report.
Yes, yeah, the Fisher report. And that's the only thing.
And do we know from looking at the record where he came up with that?
No, Your Honor, except for some of his testimony, and I reviewed some of the documents.
So what in your view, are the most problematic, assuming that there is a gradation of problematicness, statements in your view are testimonial hearsay?
Well, I mean, testifying that his DNA was on her and her DNA was on him, as well as the testing was done in accordance with the proper procedures and protocols. In essence, the defense counsel attempted to ask the expert, Mr. Davenport, you know, a series of questions about contamination, about manipulation, and given the history that this court's ruling with the United States versus Luke case, you know, all he got from the Mr. Davenport was, I don't know, and knows, and I couldn't know that.
Can I ask you a question about prejudice, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whereas in this case, the issue was never whether or not sex had occurred, right, but whether it was consensual or not. Am I correct about that?
Well, I mean, after the admission of this DNA evidence, after this erroneous admission, and the fact that the expert, as I previously just said, that he didn't know if any of these other things happened, the defense at that point didn't have another way to attack. This was not a case where the accused went up and told OSI or told the investigating officer, I had sex with the girl, it was consensual. The only thing that the defense was left to attack was, you know, basically beyond a reasonable doubt, we don't know where the semen came from. We don't know how the semen could have gotten. And that's what the defense was left with, because the government basically shielded the expert who would have been testifying for him to be able to attack, to see if there's cross-contamination, to see if there's manipulation, to see if any of those other factors had. There was none of that there. And if you look at prejudice and you look through the factors, it's very clear that this was important to the government's case. We know it's important to the government's case because they decided to put an expert on who didn't do the report. Instead of waiting a couple of days to have that expert actually show up, they decided to put a different expert on, which means that they really wanted to have this evidence as part of it. And further, he told the members that, hey, remember the DNA evidence. When you look at his statement and he denied what happened, remember the DNA evidence. They put it in PowerPoint. They included all of this in, as well as the FCCA had said, that on Joint Appendix page 15, footnote 10, that the prosecutor themselves said it was a substantial piece of evidence. And this burden, the government has to carry this burden to say that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And they can't carry that burden, because they themselves said what an important piece of evidence this was to the members, to the judge. The testimony was not cumulative. In fact, it was the only scientific evidence that placed the appellant within the appellee within the apartment at the time. That's no corroborating evidence. And then the amount of confrontation that he was allowed and permitted, he couldn't. He attempted to get into some of those things, and he wasn't able to. And then the strength of the prosecution's case, this did not have a strong case. You heard counsel stated earlier talking about this case, but it's pretty clear that we have recollection problems. We have no other scientific evidence that's there. We know that he was the appellee was also couldn't remember a number of things. Facts, you know, were corroborated by what OSI found him. He was unresponsive, required medical attention prior to being questioned. Most importantly, at the end of the day, they were cut off and unable to ask the question of the expert who admitted, the identifying expert who said he did it. They were unable to ask that individual the required questions that he would have needed to for the confrontation clause. And if there are no other questions.
Counsel, I just have a question that really doesn't go to the substance of it. The CCA developed a summary of the lab procedures in their opinion. Does the defense agree that that's an accurate summary of the procedures?
For the most part, Your Honor. I mean, I have some quibbling differences, but I mean, for the most part, it's
okay. Thank you.
Now, in regard to your prejudice analysis, you were saying that this was the only scientific evidence.
Yes, sir.
Well, certainly that's true, but you had the accused providing his own version of events that placed him there having sex. So,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The accused was saying that it was an issue of consent, not an issue of whether he was there.
It seemed that the penultimate issue in the case was whether this was, you know, his DNA or not. The appellee at trial, yeah, did raise, you know, a consent offense, but there was no evidence of consent that was admitted. The mistake of fact as to consent defense wasn't instructed, despite being asked. I don't believe that's in the joint appendix. I think that's just.
I think that Judge Olson's asking the same question I was asking, which is, where his defense was not, this isn't my semen, but rather, this wasn't rape. How was the prejudice? And I had thought that your answer was because it was all that they were left with. But when was the motion, when was the issue with respect to the testimony, when did it come up, before trial or during trial?
It came up before trial, so I had to make that decision.
Okay, so it was resolved before trial, before openings?
Prior to openings, the expert stated during the 39A session, the expert stated he did not know all of the evidence of the cross-contamination and things of that sort.
Now, to what extent, though, if you're saying he had no choice but to go along this route, presumably if he was saying to his defense counsel, hey, that wasn't me, I don't understand how it possibly could tie me to this DNA evidence, we need to bring in our own DNA evidence expert to testify about how this could be wrong. So when you're saying that all of his options were taken off the table by this testimony of Davenport, is that really accurate?
I believe from the record, I mean, some of the extrapolations I believe that are out there isn't necessarily clear on the record in those ways. It seems to me that the prosecutors attempted to ask about cross-contamination, attempted to ask about the potential manipulations and other problems with the sample. They got no's, they got I don't know's, and because they weren't able to adequately do that, they had to make a decision at that point. And I think that's what's clear from the record.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel with the government, rebuttal, please.
Counsel, before you get started, I want to ask you the same question I asked the defense. Does the government agree with the summary that the CCA set forth as to the lab procedures?
Generally, Your Honor, yes. With regard to Mr. Davenport, I just want to point out some portions in the joint appendix. I know that some of the judges had questions about that. The first point I'd like to point you to is joint appendix at 292. Mr. Davenport testified, quote, I start with looking at the documents that were submitted by the agency to make sure that the tag numbers are properly reflected in the report, to make sure the items that were submitted are actually listed on the report, and I'll go through the entire process. He continues on the joint appendix at 292. He reviewed the analysis of both same kits from beginning to end. He also testified in his review at the motions hearing, joint appendix at 72. He asks himself when he goes through the case file, did they record steps properly? Were the positive and negative controls tested? Did they have the lot numbers written down? I look at the results that came up with those three tests to see if they were accurately reflected in the report. It goes on later. The lab file contains everything from beginning to end, the documents that were submitted to the agency. That's on Joint Appendix 82. He also testified on pages 83 and 84 at the motions hearing, if the samples got switched, I could see it. He also testified at 84, if someone else's semen was substituted for Katsos, I could identify that. Taking all that together, the members could make the inference that Mr. Davenport had, this was circumstantial evidence, that he could connect the actual sample, the known samples from Katso and from the victim in this case, to the ultimate conclusion that those DNA profiles had matched. And that is exactly like a urinalysis case where a surrogate expert comes in, reviews a case file with no personal knowledge of where those samples came from, other than chain of custody documents, and then testifies, oh yes, for sure, that is the accused sample.
And is there anywhere there where he equates the batch number to cancel?
Not specifically the batch, not the number itself, Your Honor, to Katso, no, Your Honor. If this court, and Your Honor, if I could briefly conclude.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. If this court accepts appellee's contention that only the individual who performed the complete testing can testify without risking a Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause violation, then the rules controlling expert witness testimony would be rendered hollow, as I mentioned before. Mr. Davenport's...
Well, just a second, counsel, which if in fact there's a Confrontation Clause problem, the fact that it would ruin the rules regarding expert testimony is kind of irrelevant, don't you agree? I mean, they have to be able to render their expert opinion without violating the Confrontation Clause. And if it violates the Confrontation Clause, it means that they can't testify based on the way that the rules are, which do you think trumps the other?
Your Honor, I think if a second expert testifies using testimonial hearsay and forms his or her own independent opinions, at that point, That would, if this court finds that that's improper, that would render 703.
Okay, that's I misheard you then.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Davenport's testimony was appropriate because he testified concerning his own actions and used Mr. Fisher's findings only insofar as they guided his own independent analysis and conclusions. Even if this court finds error, any error here was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The CCA should thus be reversed in its entirety. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel. The case is now submitted and will stand in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
The court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.